From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now! The first subpoena of a sitting president to testify has been withdrawn because he's agreed to talk. Today, we'll look at Monica Lewinsky being granted immunity, what it means for the president, more importantly, what it means for the nation. Also, who won? General Motors and the United Auto Workers have agreed to end their 7-week battle. But what did each side gain or lose? All that and more coming up on Pacifico Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton agreed yesterday to provide videotape testimony at the White House August 17th about whether he tried to illegally cover up a sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky, making him the nation's first chief executive to face questioning under oath in a grand jury investigation of his actions. Clinton, who has denied any improper relations with Lewinsky, reached a deal with independent counsel Kenneth Starr to testify after 6 months of resistance. And Justice Starr secured the cooperation of Lewinsky, who agreed Tuesday to tell the grand jury that she had an affair with the president and that they discussed ways of keeping it hidden in the Paula Jones case. In an explosion of pent-up resentment, Justice Clarence Thomas yesterday vigorously attacked his critics, both black and white, saying they had racist views because they had been unable to accept the notion that he was able to think for himself. Justice Thomas told an audience of several hundred black judges and lawyers, "I refuse to have any ideas assigned to me because I'm black." His critics, he said, have subjected him to particularly vicious and venomous assaults because his conservative views and judicial opinions since he joined the Supreme Court in 91 don't conform to what is expected of a black man. Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi today accused the military government in Burma of kidnapping her to end a 6-day standoff, saying police held her down, took the wheel of her car, and forcibly drove her back to the capital. The government admitted returning the democracy campaigner to the capital against her will yesterday evening, but has not explained its tactics. With a feverish Suu Kyi lying in the back seat of her car, where she'd slept for 5 straight nights, 2 police women held her down and other officers ejected 2 colleagues from the front seat, this according to members of her party. Speaking in Sydney, Australia today, U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright called the government's actions an unacceptable violation of human rights that would only contribute to the further isolation of Burma. The United Nations said today it had uncovered mass graves containing the bodies of 105 people killed in an attack last week in Angola. The Angolan government has blamed the former rebel group UNITA for the attack on July 22nd, which it said left 215 people dead. UNITA has denied the charge, saying the people were slaughtered by diamond gangsters. The National Labor Committee, a New York-based group that exposes sweatshop conditions in the United States and abroad, said a survey of Walmart outlets in 11 states showed that more than 85% of the private label clothing and accessories it examined were manufactured abroad, compared with an industry average of 50 to 60%. The committee challenged Walmart to make public the locations of the foreign factories that produce its clothing, including a popular line bearing the name of talk show celebrity Kathy Lee Gifford, so that working conditions at the sites can be checked by independent human rights monitors. 2 California teenagers who mounted one of the most organized and systematic hacker attacks ever on U.S. military computers pled guilty yesterday to charges of juvenile delinquency. The California hackers were cornered in February when FBI agents descended on their homes, searched their homes, and seized computers, software, and printers. Deputy Defense Secretary John Hammer told reporters the barrage was the most organized and systematic attack the Pentagon has seen to date. Dozens of campesinos and miners from northern Colombia began camping out near the gates of the U.S. Embassy in Bogota to protest U.S. support for paramilitary violence, which they say is protecting the interests of multinational mining companies. And Spain's Supreme Court sentenced a former socialist interior minister and his deputy to 10 years in jail for their involvement in a dirty war against the Basque guerrilla group ETA in the 1980s. This news from Prague, an American-sponsored radio station, soon will begin broadcasting into Iran and Iraq from a secret location in the Czech Republic. Radio Free Europe Liberty has been headquartered in Prague since 1995, but company spokesperson said the new offices for broadcasting to Iran and Iraq will be in a separate secret location because of fear they would become a target for terrorists. And the House narrowly passed a measure that would deny federal housing money to San Francisco because of the city's policies supporting live-in gay and lesbian partners. Finally, the prime ministers of India and Pakistan tentatively agreed to resume talks over the issue of Kashmir. Both described their meeting in diplomatic language that did not hide the distrust that's set in since the two nations conducted underground nuclear tests. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host, Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Juan.
Good day, Amy. And I see that the sparks were flying at the meeting of the National Bar Association with Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Of course, Justice Thomas attempted to make the overwhelming criticism by many associations of his invitation seem as a form of racism. But one judge who was a strong opponent, Judge Leon Higginbotham, who was the Chief Justice of the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the Third District, said that inviting Clarence Thomas was undeserved because, quote, he has done more to turn back the clock of racial progress than any other African-American public official in the history of this country. So that there certainly has been enormous opposition. And this is not just, this were many of the nation's top black judges attended this conference
also. As well as lawyers.
And of course, no one was denying the right of Clarence Thomas to speak. It was a question of should he be invited to that particular platform to speak.
That's right. The National Bar Association being the African-American lawyers and judges organization. And it was an organization that opposed Clarence Thomas being nominated and confirmed as a Supreme Court justice. Also, it wasn't exactly a discussion. It was a forum where Clarence Thomas spoke, but it wasn't an open forum where afterwards people could respond to what he said and they could have a dialogue. There were boos in the audience on certain of the parts of that speech, but that was the end of the discussion. But some powerful comments he made, as he said, what else could be the explanation when I fail to follow their ideology or anti-intellectual prescription? The stench of racial inferiority still confounds my olfactory nerves.
I think the man is a little ticked off.
In other news, let's see, the National Association of Black Journalists is having a big convention in Washington this weekend, which begins this week. And in Puerto Rico, Juan, a story you've been covering quite extensively, and we read this in the news headlines yesterday, it looks like GTE, the company that made a deal with the Puerto Rican government to buy the Puerto Rican phone company, which led to the massive strike of just hundreds of thousands of people and a many-day strike of phone company workers. Looks like GTE is going to buy the phone company.
Yes, of course. You have a situation there where GTE purchased the phone company in what's called a negotiated bidding process. Unlike in Brazil, where yesterday they auctioned off in a privatization move, the huge Brazilian telephone company, they broke it up into 11 parts and then had sealed bid auctions. In Puerto Rico, was a totally negotiated process with one company, which has raised a lot of suspicion, and most of it clouded in secrecy, the negotiation. So this still has to be approved by the FCC and the Justice Department. Most likely they will, but interestingly enough, even as the deal was being consummated, GTE itself was being bought up by Atlantic Bell. And isn't it interesting that Atlantic Bell's territory covers, I would say, about 90% of the Puerto Rican community in the United States, and now Atlantic Bell will also be the owners of the Puerto Rico Telephone Company.
So it looks like overall the conglomerates win out in the end.
Well, yes, I said Atlantic Bell, I meant Bell Atlantic, yes, it's the increasing concentration of the communications industries around the world. Continue.
Well, we're going to take on a major issue today. People who listen to Democracy Now! Might have noticed we tend to avoid this issue, but I think there's no avoiding it right now. President Clinton agreeing to testify for the Lewinsky grand jury, and as a result of this agreement to do this, albeit at the White House on videotape, Kenneth Starr, the independent prosecutor, has retracted the subpoena of the president, extremely significant given that it is the first time a sitting president has been called to testify, subpoenaed to testify before a federal grand jury. Well, the news almost got lost last Friday. It was overwhelmed by the Capitol shooting, where two Capitol police officers were killed by what appears to be a mentally ill man. But on that fateful afternoon, the White House chose to reveal, in the midst of that terrible incident that happened at the Capitol, the White House chose to reveal, despite the fact that the subpoena had been delivered more than a week before, they chose that moment to reveal that the president had received a subpoena ordering him to testify before the grand jury investigating allegations of a presidential affair and a cover-up. If it weren't for the shooting, of course, it would have been the banner headline, because it is the first time in American history a sitting president has been subpoenaed to testify before a federal grand jury. Next came the question, would he testify in person before the grand jury? Would the jurors come to the White House? Well, yesterday it was announced President Clinton will provide videotaped testimony on Monday, August 17th. Clinton's personal lawyers will be present for the testimony, and the independent prosecutor, Kenneth Starr, in exchange, has withdrawn the subpoena. Meanwhile, Monica Lewinsky, the former White House intern at the center of this controversy, has received full immunity from Starr in exchange for what her lawyers called full and truthful testimony to the grand jury. Lewinsky is expected to testify that she did engage in a sexual relationship with Clinton while she was working at the White House, contradicting previous sworn testimony from her and the president. We don't want to engage in speculation, though. We don't know exactly what she will say. We're joined right now by two people who've been following this issue closely. Michael Tackett is on the phone with us. He's a Washington Bureau reporter with the Chicago Tribune. And we're joined by Laura's Eric Nelson, who is your colleague at the New York Daily News, Juan, Washington-based columnist with the Daily News. Let's begin with two of your pieces that we got a chance to look at, Michael Tackett and Lars Eric Nelson. Lars Eric Nelson, you wrote in yesterday's column, "So let tomorrow's front page say Clinton to Starr, drop dead. The president supposedly hates confrontations, but this is the moment for him to stare down Starr in the Congress and say, make my day, impeach me. Things have changed a little. Can you explain what your recommendation is?"
Well, I don't think things have changed at all. The thing that troubles me about this is that we're making judgments, or the American people are being asked to make judgments on the basis of anonymous leaks, sources close to the lawyers, and so on. And I think the president and the country would be much better served if this process was out in the open, the way an impeachment process would be. That is, before cameras and in front of a House committee with Henry Hyde presiding over the hearings. You can see the witnesses, you can weigh their credibility, you have a chance to cross-examine them. I think everybody's better off with that than the series of leaks that's going to continue for the next couple of weeks anyway.
Now, explain what you mean. I mean, I don't know if people understand the full impact of what you're saying. How could President Clinton get out of testifying before this grand jury, and how then would it just be something that happens in the House around an impeachment hearing?
He could just defy the subpoena. He can say that you have no right to call me before, under the Constitution, under the separation of powers, and under the rules for removing a president from office. You've got no right to subpoena me. You can't enforce the subpoena. If I refuse, you can't send police over to the White House to arrest me. So the subpoena is invalid. I'm just going to defy it.
Lars, in your column yesterday, which I actually emailed you because I was so taken by the strength of it. You said, we've had 4 years of STARS investigations, 4 years of his harassing innocent citizens in hopes that they will say something to incriminate the president, 4 years of efforts to discover a crime, any crime, that STAR can pin on his chosen target. Could you elaborate a little bit more on what you feel that is going on in this investigation?
Well, I think this is, as I've written several times, this is not simply a dispassionate search for the truth, the objective truth, no matter where it lies, by Kenneth Starr. I think this is a political effort to topple the president and to keep looking for something that will give him the lever to do it. Ironically, he hasn't really found a crime in 4 years, and I think he's trying to create one by calling the president before a federal grand jury, putting him under oath, and trying to get him into a perjury trap. That would be a real irony if the only crime that he can actually find is if he traps the president into a perjury at the grand jury interrogation on August 17th.
Now, Michael Tackett, you wrote in the Chicago Tribune, who would the grand jury see as more credible, the president, who's not wavered from his denials, or former White House intern Monica Lewinsky, who seems to have completely changed her story after receiving a grant of immunity? Perhaps more important, if Starr sends a report to the House of Representatives saying he's found grounds for impeachment, would members of Congress try to unseat a president over a purported lie under oath about sex? Talk about your take on all of this.
Well, I think that no matter what you think about Starr, the president's got some pretty serious problems now. Starr is very clearly building a box that's going to be really hard for the president to get out of. And leaks or not, what's coming out, I think, is both a message to the president and a message to the Congress of, this is really going to be the scope of what Monica Lewinsky will say. The one advantage so far that the president has is that there seems to be very little evidence of obstruction of justice. There seems to be very little evidence that anybody else was encouraged explicitly to lie under oath. The real problem for the president is that, you know, he's really standing on this denial. And for him to be believed, then you have to ask him, why was he calling her on the phone? Why was he giving her gifts? Why was she in the White House after midnight on weekends alone? And today's revelations, which I cannot tell you that I know, but I can tell you that the New York Times and the Washington Post reported that, unfortunately, we have the reemergence of this dress that we all heard about early on in this investigation. And supposedly, the New York Times says that Lewinsky sent this dress to her mother. And now what really seems to be unfolding is that Monica Lewinsky is a little bit more sophisticated, maybe a little bit more conspiratorial than we had ever imagined. She also dropped quite a dime on her mother, putting her mother in a tremendously compromised position. So now we might know why Monica Lewinsky chose to finally come forward and accept this immunity deal and also save her mother in the process.
Why did she send it to her mother?
Well, I guess she would have to speak to that. My speculation on that would be is that she wanted to avoid turning it over as evidence, and on the other hand, have it if she ever needed it, if she were ever completely and fully threatened, which is why I think there's a lot of cunning and guile involved here.
Well, we also have Orrin Hatch, the head of the Judiciary Committee, saying, well, we've got to have a little bit more than sexual picadillos here to be deciding to go through an impeachment process. Lars, is the crux of what they're, as you said, trying to get here is a situation where the president is caught lying to a court. Now, I think that the average man in this country, and many have unfortunately committed adultery, and would, when asked the first time around or even the second time around, have you committed adultery, would most probably say, no, I haven't. The American public continues to have an enormous amount of refusal to go along with this continuing investigation. What's your sense?
Well, I hate to speculate on the adultery because there's been far too much gossip over the past 6 months. You know, people think that they're being very cynical by assuming that the guy is lying because everybody does it. And I think that's terribly unfair to everybody concerned. We're not as smart as we think we are. There's a lot of gossip that's been passed off as news, that's been passed off as fact. We now have the New York Times, as Mike says, reporting about the dress. That still is an anonymous source. We don't know. I mean, I can't imagine that the mother kept that dress in pristine condition, didn't have it dry cleaned or whatever. I'm surprised she didn't burn it, given the way they were trying so hard to cover up. But it's still, it's an anonymous source claiming that there's evidence that would support Lewinsky's testimony.
It's interesting also, by the way, that dress was a subject of Pressgate and Brill's content, you
right.
know, just when it was first reported.
Right.
Who are these sources saying these things?
Well, if there is such a dress, the president would have to be a psychopath to go before a grand jury if he knows he's got DNA evidence that's going to contradict his story.
Yeah, I mean, that's the real problem. Of course, to prove that, then the president would have to give a blood sample.
Well, that would become the next constitutional
yeah.
crisis, you know.
And so, I mean, I think Lars goes to the heart of this, though, in many respects, and that is that this has to go beyond the relationship, I think, for Congress to really want to seriously take this up, because as salacious as all this is, Congress really doesn't want to have the mirror of scrutiny turned back on to them. And that's exactly what would happen if this is the only thing that goes up there. So I tell you the truth, I suspect strongly that Starr is going to send up a report that has far more in that. Now, on careful examination, it might all be reduced to rubble. But if he sends that report up, you can make sure that it will read like the biggest kitchen sink indictment of all time.
Michael Tackett, Lars Ark Nelson, we have to break for stations to ID themselves, but we're going to come back with you for some wrap-up. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we discuss the latest developments, the first time a sitting president has been subpoenaed to testify before a grand jury. It's now been retracted because he's agreed to talk. Stay with us.
Welcome back to the Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez, and we're here talking with Michael Tackett, Washington Bureau reporter with the Chicago Tribune, and my colleague Lars Ark Nelson, my colleague at the New York Daily News, who's a Washington-based columnist for the news. And Michael, I'd like to begin with you again, just in a few closing comments. What is your sense, for instance, as my reading of a lot of the reports of these leaks indicate that whatever conversation apparently occurred between President Clinton and Monica Lewinsky over what they would agree to deny apparently occurred in December. Now, was this prior to her actual subpoena? And if it was, would that have any bearing on whether there was a conscious conspiracy to obstruct justice?
Well, the timeline in these things is always critical, and it's going to be critical in this case. There seem to be two relevant time periods. One is when the president knew that her name was on a witness list, which would mean that he would have known she could have been subject to a subpoena at some point. And then the second would be after the subpoena itself came down. He's in much more peril if he or anybody else did anything after she formally received the subpoena. I would say there is some peril if any actions were taken to shape or shade her testimony if they knew she was a likely witness.
And Lars, what's your sense of that?
Well, it also gets back down to what was the situation when she was testifying. It's an affidavit in a civil suit. Her affidavit was then ruled immaterial to the suit, and the suit itself was eventually thrown out. I don't think any citizen in the country has ever been prosecuted for making a false statement or asking somebody else to tailor the testimony in an affidavit in a civil suit that got tossed out. So that's pretty thin stuff. I think what Starr is going to try to do is make, as Michael said, a big kitchen sink complaint that says there's a pattern of obstruction of justice that goes back to the travel office firings and the Rose Law Firm, and try to put all that together. It'll look like something like the famous Christic Institute suit, in which everything goes back to the Nguyen Bank and the CIA in Laos.
But ultimately, when the smoke clears from this, does anyone really believe that the Republican Party wants to impeach President Clinton and risk the possibility, or attempt to impeach President Clinton and risk the possibility that Al Gore would be a sitting president as a new presidential election campaign begins?
Well, there are some who do, and unfortunately, the Republican Party in a pre-election period often responds much more to its activists and the fundraising types rather than to the broad public. I think, you know, the broad mass of Republican voters and maybe the broad mass of Republican elected officials would not want to do it. But when you're trying to generate money for your campaigns, you do tend to appeal to the ones who are going to get most excited, and they want impeachment.
Michael, what's your sense of this whole issue of whether they want him out?
I don't know that they want him out. I do know that they like the idea of exciting the base of their party. As Lars said, a lot of those people, believe it or not, would still like to have one more reason to vote against Bill Clinton, even though he'll never be on the ballot again. So I suspect part of that. You know, I don't know if this is false hope or not, but I just think in the end, this is going to go to probably the judgment in many ways of Henry Hyde of the House Judiciary Committee. And he's certainly got a reputation for probity and integrity, and he's got a team of people who I don't think would put the American people through this if it were simply about somebody's personal relations. I think it's going to have to be far more serious and far more extensive before they're going to be willing to do that, because it would backfire.
In terms of the impact of this on the coming congressional elections, is there danger either way in terms of having an impact on? Certainly, the House is still very closely divided, even though the Republicans have a majority. Any chance of this having an impact on the overall elections of the House?
I think not, unless something moves very quickly and is very explosive. Right now, Democrats were saying earlier in the year that they had a realistic chance for a takeover. Not very many are saying that now. So either Starr would have to do something that would engender an incredible amount of resentment and cause people to come out and vote, or else the far more likely scenario is the status quo will prevail.
I want to thank you both very much for joining us and making some sense of all of this. Let me ask a final question, which is, how do you feel covering this day in and day out? It seems to me, when I'm watching television, it is like a separate reality. I turn to the Sunday talk shows. We hardly touch this, and it's all they talk about. Do you feel degraded at all?
Well, there's far too much speculation. There's far too much anonymous sources. Anonymous sources are fine as long as you tell the people which side they're on or where they're coming from. But I see way too much reporting now that just says legal sources or sources close to the negotiations. And those are self-serving leaks almost universally, and you ought to know which self is being served. And that's the big frustration for me.
Yeah, I guess there are sometimes when I want to go home and wash my hands.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Lars Eric Nelson, Washington-based columnist for the New York Daily News, and Michael Tackett, Washington Bureau reporter with the Chicago Tribune.
Hey,
you're listening
Monica
to Pacifica
Lewinsky,
Radio.
What the hell are you doing in this song, Monica Lewinsky? We know you didn't do anything wrong, Monica Lewinsky. Now everybody everywhere peculiar kind of fame. You're a pawn in a crooked game, Monica Lewinsky.
And that is Monica Lewinsky by David Gans and the Broken Angels. And as he sings in this piece, Monica Lewinsky, what the hell are you doing in this song? And it goes on from there.
Well, we're going to go to another issue right now, another sort of who won, who lost issue. Very significant, the issue of the UAW strike against General Motors. More than 9,000 members of the United Auto Workers ratified agreements yesterday to end the nearly eight-week strike at two auto parts factories in Michigan, a dispute that shut down GM assembly plants across North America. About 90% of the workers at GM's Flint Meadow plant voted to ratify their pact, while stronger worries about future job security at the Delphi East plant held the approval vote there to about three-quarters, 76%. The Flint Meadow and Delphi East plants waged two of the longest and costliest strikes against the automaker in nearly 30 years, costing GM an estimated $2.5 billion in short-term losses, and possibly more seriously, further eroding its share of the U.S. auto market. Production rates and health and safety grievances are important in the battle between the auto giant and the union. But some labor analysts say the issue that really matters to the two sides is who gets to control GM's redesigned 1999 Chevrolet Silverado pickup and its sister truck slated to be launched in September. In fact, there was an interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal this week on what's really behind GM's strike, and it talks specifically about the Silverado. Right now, we're joined by Harley Shaken, who's a professor specializing in labor issues at the University of California at Berkeley. Juan?
Yes, I'd like to welcome Harley Shaken. He's been a guest here before, and begin just basically by asking you this question. Who do you think won this strike? Who lost, or was it a draw? And what does it mean in terms of the labor movement over the next few years?
Well, good morning. I think what happened here is a bit unusual. In a press conference right after the settlement, the UAW's president, Steve Jokic, when asked that very question, said, "We both lost." And I think what he meant by that isn't that the union didn't wage an effective strike. I think by all accounts it waged a very effective strike. But rather, this was a strike that was initiated by GM. GM took the union on. There weren't contract negotiations that were taking place, but rather GM, in the union's mind, was seeking to undermine the local agreement and, in many ways, the national agreement. So what the union waged here was a highly effective defensive strike, but under circumstances that it would rather not have engaged in. That is, the union didn't come out of this winning something, but it did manage to preserve what it had. It showed the power of the strike. But it was a situation where it would rather that GM had not initiated this in the first place.
Well, one of the interesting issues raised in this Wall Street Journal article a couple of days ago, was that the strike caught the national union leadership as unaware as it did General Motors. That in some sense, the national union leadership underestimated the degree of frustration that workers at these particular plants and other GM workers are feeling over the issue of the continual shifting of capital investment to Mexico and to other countries. What's your sense of that?
That's probably overstated a bit, although there's an important point there, which is these strikes were not orchestrated from the top. It wasn't Steve Jokic, the president of the union, or Richard Shoemaker, the GM vice president, who were sitting in Detroit saying, let's see what plants we can pull out. But rather, there's enormous discontent throughout the GM system. Workers have deep doubts about the corporation's credibility and are very fearful about sizable numbers of jobs moving to Mexico. So there are any number of plants where the tempers are hot and workers are angry. It happens that when the union brought these two plants out, when the national union okayed the locally initiated strikes, there was hope that they might be resolved sooner. But the national union and the locals really dug in their heels because they realized that given the constraints of bargaining over local grievances, that is, the union didn't have demands on the table, they were simply arguing that GM had to live up to the contract. Given those constraints, the union could have had an enormous defeat and managed to stave that off, so in that sense it was a victory. But a lot was constrained here by the fact that the major issues that divide the parties were not directly on the table. Where investment takes place, how GM restructures, whether UAW workers benefit or lose from the company's drive for competitiveness.
But on a very practical level, if you were to look at the physical evidence here, this strike started when a bunch of stamping equipment at one particular plant was removed over Memorial Day weekend, and it seems to have ended when the equipment was brought back. So that, I mean, can't you say from the workers' point of view that they at least, in terms of the local direct issue that this strike started over, that in essence they were able to stop that particular action of General Motors as representing to them an overall trend that they felt a lot of frustration with?
Yes, I think the whole issue of the dies is symbol for an important victory. That is, the union did win some important gains here in a strike that it didn't initiate, but nonetheless, I think that's very important to emphasize. That was a victory. What happened is GM removed the dies from the stamping plant. These are sheet metal forms, or rather, these are metal forms that stamp sheet metal for GM's most important product launch in a decade, a new truck that's coming out this fall. GM removed the dies in late May because it planned to produce the sheet metal parts in Ohio and ship them for assembly to a Canadian plant. What then happened is the Canadian Auto Workers Union said they wouldn't put the parts on the trucks. And when GM heard that, it had little choice but to sit on the dies. Ironically, the dies were damaged in transit, and then as a sign the union was close to victory, the corporation shipped the dies back to Flint. This is probably the most expensive movement of dies in recorded history, but it does symbolize the fact that while GM may have flirted with a caterpillar-like strategy, these strikes effectively shut the corporation down.
Is there any sense what the impact was on workers in Mexico? Because after all, there are so many General Motors plants. I think Delphi alone has about 53 plants in Mexico, and that General Motors is already the largest private employer in Mexico. What's been the impact on the Mexican labor movement of what they see occurring in the United States?
Well, this is probably the most important underreported story of this whole strike. We are now looking at a fully integrated North American production system at GM and at other automakers. So one little footnote here, when GM early on in the strike began reporting how many workers were laid off and what plants were shut down, when you saw the list, it wasn't broken out separately by country. Mexican plants, Canadian plants, and U.S. plants were listed right on the same list. In effect, they are economically part of the same economic area under NAFTA, and in terms of GM's organization, they're all part of the same company. There are no geographic borders there. Most Delphi plants, and that's GM's parts-making subsidiary in Mexico, are not unionized. They're mostly maquiladoras or border assembly plants, so there, labor didn't have a role one way or another. In one major new assembly plant where trucks are produced in Silao, Mexico, there is a union, but it tends to be a very government-dominated official union. That could prove to be very problematic for the UAW in the future if that kind of a situation continues. As I mentioned a moment ago, the Canadian auto workers were central to ensuring that the dies were not used once they left Flint. But had this strike continued, GM was operating its truck assembly plant in Silao, and trucks are the most important profit center at the entire corporation. If GM expands its production in Mexico, then a strike in North America would increasingly only be shutting down a part of General Motors. So while there wasn't an official reaction within the auto industry in Mexico, that is, within the labor movement in the auto industry, that's a key area for the future.
One final question. The focus now shifts to the Saturn plant, which actually did vote a strike authorization vote, but their issues have still to be negotiated. We had on the air last week the chairman of the Saturn Negotiating Committee. What's your sense of what's going to happen there?
That's an open question. I think the fact that Saturn is so much the symbol of labor management cooperation in the United States and clearly in the automobile industry, the fact that a strike vote was taken there was pretty shocking. It doesn't mean there will be a strike, but what the Saturn workers were in particular upset about, I think, wasn't so much what was taking place at Saturn, but rather an increased GM role that was eroding the power of the union at Saturn. And it was many of the same issues that we saw so dramatically at Flint that are also causing turmoil at Saturn, where parts are made, who has control over many of the important issues here, how workers are affected by the restructuring. They're in negotiation now. A strike is by no means inevitable, but the fact that a strike vote at all was taken is a major watershed.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for being with us again, Harley Shaken, professor at the University of California at Berkeley, specializing in labor issues. And we're going to be keeping an eye on the continuing developments at General Motors as the strike against the largest corporation in the world ends with at least a significant labor victory in this labor movement that has been declared dead so many times now that it's amazing how it continues to come back. Thank you very much, Harley Shaken. And we're going to take a break right now. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Listener-sponsored community radio.
For news, entertainment, and information,
this is WBAI
99.5 FM in New York.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Several dozen people are just completing the first week of their hunger strike outside the U.S. mission to the United Nations. The activists are demanding that the United States immediately lift its economic blockade against Iraq. Earlier in the week, we spoke with one of those hunger strikers, Kathy Kelly, one of the founders of Voices in the Wilderness. Today, we'll hear from former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. While he's not currently fasting, he too has repeatedly decried the sanctions and spent time in Iraq. He spoke recently at a gathering of activists at the Bruderhof community in upstate New York.
Now, as I talk about our conduct in this one little epoch toward Iraq, I'll point out first that it is directly and painfully related to our history with Iran. For 25 years, Iran was the U.S. surrogate in this region. From the day in 1953 when what we proudly called the moment we restored the Shah to his throne, he was in his early 20s, why we had such affinity for the peacock throne that we never had for King George III's is another question, probably. But that's what we claimed to do, and in fact that's what we did. And the consequence, not just for the people of Iran for the next 25 years, that's a fourth of a century, was stunning brutality and violence and degradation, culturicide and homicide, and for many, genocide. The Iran-Iraq war was a direct consequence, without question, of that 25 years of misery, in which we urged, without question, Iraq to, which is 28-29% the population of Iran, and before the collapse of the Shah, not 15% of the economic power, and in which more than 1 million very young men lost their lives, and at the beginning of which our preeminent foreign policy advisor, Henry Kissinger, said, "I hope they kill each other." There's a humanitarian thought. I hope they kill each other. So 1 million young men go out to die. And we backed Iraq to the hilt. For 25 years, we had provided the Shah with anything he wanted in the way of military equipment, training, aid of any kind. We ought to have. He spent tens of billions of dollars. Between 1972 and 1976, $22 billion in arms sold by the United States to Iran. 3 weapon systems we were able to finance because of Iranian purchases. We wouldn't have done it otherwise. I mean, how lucky can you get? And here was our surrogate with more tanks than the British Army, installing Bell helicopter factories. You don't want them flying a Bell helicopter that's put together, fabricated in Iran, I'll tell you. Or in a British motorworks car, which they were also fabricating. They break down every 10 miles. I rode in them quite a few times, and they weren't roadworthy for a minute. The Iran-Iraq war occurred precisely because of our oppression in the region through our surrogate, who was also our central distribution center for commercial, industrial, and other products in 8 or 10 countries, a pretty big market. And after the Shah had fallen, after 25 years of misery, what to many seemed even greater misery. I mean, it's very naive to believe that you can come out of a long period of torture and division and torment and repression and suddenly blossom into perfect joy. Because there are guns everywhere. You're conditioned to violence. You had children conditioned to violence. I sat with Pham Van Dong in Hanoi during the bombings of 1971 when we were trying to knock out the dikes. And he sat there somberly and said at one point in the conversation, "The thing that worries me is what has this generation of violence done to our children? We remember. We knew what it was like before. We understand. They've lived in nothing but violence from the day they were born. Military violence is the glory." So chaos in Iran continued. And William Colby, who had been with the CIA most of those 25 years and director at the end of the period, about 3 years later wrote, "The proudest achievement of the CIA is the restoration of the Shah to the throne of Iran, because it gave us dominance of that vital region for 25 years. When we lost that, we had to replace it. Because our geopolitical judgment was that whoever controlled that crossroads between Northeast Africa and Southwest Asia, the Middle East and Europe, and 60% at least of the oil resources of the world would be in the dominant worldwide trade position for the next 40 to 50 years. And we intended to be that power. And we had to find a substitute. First, we had lost the power we had built. We had to have it attacked. and weakened. We wanted them to kill each other. The United States had determined that the only power sufficient to hold the region for the foreseeable future was its own forces. The incredible thing is they've told us this all the time. They write it, they speak it, they say it. The two things I really want you to think about as we go through what's happened to Iraq are these. How is it, in the midst of all we've seen and heard and felt and known about, first, our devastation of Iraq by bombing without ever setting foot on it? We watched it night and day on television. And then 8 long years of frozen deprivation. No food, no medicine, no clean water, no chance for health or growth or knowledge, anything. Nothing for you except sickness and pain and death. How is it that after all we've seen and known all this time, we, the people of the United States, en masse, haven't risen up and said to our government, stop. No. And the other question is, how is it that at the United Nations, which was created by we, the peoples of the world, to end the scourge of war, that during all this period, and particularly for 8 years, where the United States representative would look them in the eye and tell them one falsehood after another, one absurd scenario after another as to why the sanctions had to be continued, they went meekly along with very little protest for nearly all of those years. Because unless we address those two questions and act to do something about them, as Martin Luther King said in his Riverside Church speech in 1967, in 10 years there'll be another Vietnam. Well, actually, in 10 years there have been about 3 more, if you want me to count them for you, and since then there have been about 15 more. We have to come to grips with this. But let's look at what we did to Iraq. Here's this cradle of civilization with all of its cultures and peoples and history. It doesn't make them as individuals more worthy than Liberians or Timorese or Tibetans or anybody else. But it makes it important that there be respect for that history, because it is something that has permeated all cultures, all knowledge, and all existing civilizations. And respect ought to be paid. And here the United States, with its capacity for technological violence and devastation, systematically, for 42 days, night and day, bombed from afar without ever setting foot on an entire nation that was utterly defenseless, and we knew it. Killing thousands and thousands and thousands of people. At one time, the Defense Intelligence Agency was boasting 200,000. At one time, a former Secretary of the Navy said, we believe at least 200,000 during the bombing. The DIA now has formally settled down, but it's silent about it, on 150,000. And that's the least of it. Because what was all the bombing about? They were just sitting there. There wasn't a thing they could do. We said, they'd ask, why the power system? Why the water system? Why the food chain? Because we are supporting the sanctions. Because we know this country must not regain power. And we've held the sanctions on now since Hiroshima Day. I don't know whether we chose Hiroshima Day on purpose, but it's a story in itself that these sanctions began on Hiroshima Day, August the 6th, 1990. Suppose to a community in the neighborhood here, you decided to surround it to make sure the water system didn't have good water anymore, to cut off the importation of food, medicine, to keep traffic from going in and out, to deny them medicine, having destroyed their health care system and damaged most of their hospitals, and left their supplies completely depleted before the end of the war. It's not a war, it's a slaughter. And just held them like that for 8 years. Well, they'd all die. Except people are clever, you know. And the desire for survival is strong. And you find ways to make out. It's incredible to go into the hospitals and see the ingenuity of these doctors who ought to win Nobel Prizes for humanitarian efforts because they can imagine every type of holistic medical support for what they're doing. They can become mechanics and structure things for dialysis machines that the inventor wouldn't have thought of. Because they got to make the machine work if they possibly can, and for incubators and all the rest, so that finally out of 40, after 8 years, they might have two still going without an original part in it, you know, except maybe the wheels. Probably not them. The will to survive is strong. We know who is directly attacked by sanctions. You don't need to read a book or even be there. It's infanticide by the tens of thousands. UNICEF, which is not considered a radical organization, reported that as of the 6th of August 1991, the end of the first year of sanctions, 47,500 children under the age of five had died as a direct result of the sanctions. Now, any person in the United States that can read and cares or hear or talk could find that out. Most would probably know it, but it would pass right through us because we are anesthetized by the circuses that Rome is giving us, a little bread and big circuses. And the circuses are TV and radio and celebrity antics and Monica Lewinsky's and vulgar, common, meaningless stuff, night and day. And the desire for things. I need a new VCR, I need a new car, I want something, gimme, gimme. Our little children being trained night and day to want physical possessions, acquisition, greed. So we don't notice that the sanctions, we're told, hey, the sanctions, Iraq, 1 year, August 1991 now, 47,500 children under five killed by the sanctions. Infant mortality rate is astronomical there, astronomical. The overall death rate is astronomical. For Kuwait, it's 2.2 per thousand in 1997, according to the yearbook for Encyclopedia Britannica. In Iraq, it's 8.9. In Jordan, which is a much poorer country than Iraq was, it's 3.2.
Former Attorney General Ramsey Clark speaking two weekends ago at the Bruderhof community in upstate New York. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call the Pacifica Archives and order a cassette by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hee-Soo Koo and Jeremy Scahill. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Special thanks to Samori Marksman for recording help. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
This is Donna Neiman of the Development Department at WBAI Radio, speaking to you from our beautiful new studios at 120 Wall Street. I'd like to remind you that our new general information number is 212-209-2800. That's 212-209-2800. For questions regarding your subscription, call 212-209-2845. And if you have questions about your premium, call 212-209-2848. Again, the main number here at WBAI is now 212-209-2800. Thank you for your support, and keep listening to WBAI Radio 99.5 FM in New York.